for Enemy Combatant Radio. I'm Liam O'Donohue. The topic today is the conflict in the Darfur region of Sudan. I'll be talking today with Shane Bauer, an independent journalist who recently returned from the war-torn nation. We'll be discussing the root causes of this genocidal turmoil, which are often ignored or distorted by the mainstream media. We'll also be talking about the resistance groups, the refugees, and the environmental devastation in this North African nation. Shane, thanks for joining me today for this Enemy Combatant Radio news segment. First, tell the listeners a bit about yourself and why you decided to visit Darfur.
I think it's really important to, for one, to have these conflicts kind of on in the global radar, which this one really hasn't been. And I think it's important to kind of give a perspective from, you know, the ground, which is like from the civilian population, and also the rebels, which have been neglected mostly by the mainstream media, and to kind of like give, you know, support to these resistances that are happening around, you know, around the world, and especially with this crisis, which is probably, you know, the largest crisis in the world right now, in Darfur.
And could you get into the origins of this conflict? I know most of the news we read about in mainstream media is very decontextualized, just kind of focuses on the day-to-day or gives a very one-sided perspective. And a lot of people don't really know how this started, how far back it goes. And I think it would be very enlightening if you could kind of get into the origins of, you know, the history of what's happening now in Darfur.
Yeah, I think that's really important. A lot of conflicts in Africa and, you know, especially right now with Darfur, they're kind of attributed to these age-old inter-ethnic rivalries. And it just kind of reinforces stereotypes that people have about Africa, that it's kind of like these unsolvable problems. And with Darfur, the explanation that you usually hear is conflicts between agriculturalists and pastoralists, which is part of the picture. You know, there's been conflict in Darfur since the 80s, because with...
Could you just clarify the term pastoralists?
Pastoralists are, they're kind of like the nomadic population that they subsist on just grazing livestock. So they move from place to place, just bringing their livestock to grasslands to graze. But with global warming and desertification throughout northern Africa, that land base that has, you know, that has grazing land has gotten smaller and smaller. So people, these nomadic pastoralists have been kind of pushed into the lands of the sedentary population, the agriculturalists, which has created conflict in Darfur. And in Darfur, the nomadic population are largely Arab, and the settled population are black African. But this is only a part of the picture, and these conflicts really have been exploited by the Sudanese government. And I mean, the real problem here is the Sudanese government and centralized power in Sudan. And I don't think there's enough attention given to this or enough attention given to the rebellion in Sudan or in Darfur. And this kind of started in 2001, 2002 with a group called the Sudanese Liberation Army that rose up against the government demanding basic services like roads, education, hospitals.
They were making these demands on behalf of the agriculturalists.
On the behalf of the Darfuri population in general.
Okay.
I mean, this is kind of a separate thing from these pre-existing conflicts that were happening. This is just, Darfur is, you know, it's the poorest place I've ever been, and I've, you know, done a lot of traveling in the world, and I've never seen anything like Darfur. It's just empty desert, and, you know, there's these kind of interdispersed villages of huts, but people really have nothing. And so we're making these demands on behalf of not just Darfur, but all of the marginalized regions in Sudan, which is the south and the west also, southwest and east, Darfur being in the west. So they were making these demands for all of Darfur, the black and Arab population. And when they started this, like, armed revolt in Darfur, the government responded by using these pre-existing conflicts. So they armed these this nomadic population, which were the Arabs. And
is that what is commonly referred to as the Janjaweed?
Yeah, the Janjaweed, which in local dialect means devils on horseback. So they use these militias to just kind of wipe out the black population because the rebels were, you know, black Darfuris.
So you're basically saying that the genocide has been sanctioned by the Sudanese government. Basically, the Sudanese government is allowing the nomadic tribes or populations to kind of wipe out the native Darfurians in the southern and western parts of the country?
Yeah, but it's not just being sanctioned by the Sudanese government. The genocide is being waged by the Sudanese government. They're just using this kind of local conflict to wage a proxy war and kind of take their hands off. But these Janjaweed militias have been armed, financed, and trained by the Sudanese government. And the people in Darfur don't separate the Janjaweed and the Sudanese government. I mean, a lot of the Janjaweed wear military uniforms. And in 2004, when the most intense attacks were happening against the civilian population, what would happen would be that the Janjaweed would come in on their horses, and the government would come with planes, and they would bomb the villages. They were dropping bombs on these reed huts, and the Janjaweed would come in and steal livestock and kind of attack people from the ground. But it was a combined effort. And after 2004, when there was kind of a little bit more international attention, the government stopped bombing villages, but they kept using these Janjaweed militias to kind of wage a proxy war and to be able to, look like they're disconnected from it a little bit.
I see. So right now we're on the phone with Shane Bauer, international independent journalist on Enemy Combatant Radio. He recently wrote a cover story for the Fault Lines newspaper of Indy Bay. I encourage everyone to check out that free newspaper. And right now he's just answering some of our questions about the conflict in Darfur, dispelling some of the myths and getting in some of the real forces behind this genocide. One of the things that you focus on in the article, Shane, is how the government has offered a supposed peace agreement to the SLA rebel army in the Darfur region, and it's kind of causing some schisms, some splits between the various rebel factions, and a lot of them don't really consider it a peace agreement. Can you explain why some of the groups in the SLA are rejecting the so-called peace agreement by the Sudanese government?
Yeah. So the Sudanese government offered this peace agreement, and it was supported very strongly by the international community as the kind of way to bring peace to Darfur. So the U.S. and the U.N. were, fully supporting this, and also the U.N. was threatening to put sanctions on groups that wouldn't sign this peace agreement. But this peace agreement has been completely rejected by the population in Darfur and the refugee population in Chad because it doesn't meet any of these initial demands that this rebellion started for. It doesn't say anything about any of these basic services, any health care, anything like that. And also, it gives no guarantee of security for the refugees to return home. Every refugee I talked to while I was in Chad says that they feel certain that if they return, they're going to be slaughtered immediately. There's been several factions for the past year or two in Darfur, several rebel factions fighting the Sudanese government, but the most powerful faction of the SLA, which was led by Mini Minawi, signed the agreement, and the rest of the rebel groups rejected it because it wasn't, they say it's an empty agreement. It doesn't really have any guarantees of security, any guarantee of change. It doesn't say anything about how the Janjaweed are going to be disarmed. So there's kind of a view among the population that this group, or not really the group, but the leader, Mini Minawi, has signed this agreement just to kind of get some power in the Sudanese government.
Oh, hi, Shane. This is Fernando in the studio. Could you explain what kind of government is actually in the Sudan?
The government in Sudan now is led by Omar al-Bashir. And he kind of took power through a coup about 20 years ago. So right now it's just a dictatorship led by Omar al-Bashir, and it practices Sharia law in the north of Sudan. And there's a little bit of a different system in South Sudan, but in Darfur it's the same. It's, the same policy as the rest of the north.
And one of the biggest effects of the genocide has been a displacement of so many native Darfuris across northern Africa. I know there was a horrible massacre in Egypt a few months back where refugee camp in a park in downtown Egypt was basically slaughtered by the police. And one of the things I know you've been talking about and writing about is a situation in Chad right now that has been caused by 40,000 internally displaced people from Darfur living in camps in Chad and the growing environmental crisis there. Can you kind of get into the refugee situation, how it's affecting the neighboring country, specifically Chad?
Yeah, there's a couple of big issues. One is the 40,000 internally displaced people that are actually Chadians that have been displaced by Janjaweed. This term, Janjaweed in Chad, kind of takes on a different meaning. People are not really sure who these people are, who the Janjaweed are. But what is happening is they're being attacked. The people that live along the border, the Sudanese border, have been attacked, and their villages have been emptied, and their livestock have been taken. So they've kind of moved inland and settled down in these internally displaced people's camps. So there's kind of a clear sign that this is coming from Darfur, that these militias are coming from Darfur and crossing back over the border with the livestock. So this has been a huge issue in Chad over the past. It really started about 4 or 5 months ago. And at the same time, there's the issue of having a huge refugee population in Chad. There's about 200,000 refugees, Darfuri refugees in Chad. And this has put a large strain on the environment in Chad, East Chad is really the same as Darfur as far as, like, access to resources and the local environment. So when you have... Now you have camps of like 10 to 30,000 people all, you know, concentrated into one space, and this has just wiped out the wood supply, which is one of the most important resources that people have is dead wood they use for making fires and cooking food, and also the water supply is draining fast. And this is causing tensions between Darfuri refugees and Chadians because usually the population of refugees outnumbers the population of Chadians, and the Chadians feel that they're having the resources taken by these refugees.
I see. There's a lot of problematic issues with people outside of Africa dealing with African problems, and it seems like there's an unfortunate situation in Darfur right now where the best solution for the people in Darfur would probably be a international intervention to protect them from the Sudanese government, but in doing so, that's kind of an imperialistic answer. Write for some radical publications. I know, you're definitely not trying to advocate any kind of international imperialist solution. So can you kind of talk about, contextualize how you've tried to kind of advocate a good solution for the people in Darfur that isn't kind of just like putting them at the mercy of the international community, and also kind of how like the American right-wing community has been using this conflict to paint it more as like Muslims versus Christians, or like painting like people of the Islamic faith as like the evildoers in this scenario?
Yeah, this has been something I thought a lot about, and it's definitely a sticking point for me as a radical dealing with international intervention. But one thing I want to clear up first, which is often misrepresented about Darfur, is that the entire population of Darfur is Muslim, and the government is Muslim. So it's not like a Christian Muslim thing. It's often portrayed that way in the media. I've seen it written in mm-hmm. newspapers, and
definitely,
yeah. And this is a huge problem. I mean, it's just absolutely false. The North-South conflict is a different thing. There was a Christian population in the South. But as far as international intervention, this is a big question I had when I went to Darfur and Chad. When I go to these places, my main thing is to ask people what they think they need. And everybody that I talk to, in all the refugees I talk to, the first thing they say is they want international intervention. They want UN peacekeepers in Darfur. And right now there's an international force. There's African Union there. They've been there for about a year, but people are really angry about the African Union because they haven't, solved the problem. It hasn't gotten any better. So they think that if the UN comes, they'll be able to, have a larger impact. And I think to a certain extent it's true. If the international force does come and has more troops, it will make it easier for people to return. But I kind of predict that the same problem will happen after the UN comes, that people really have a lot of faith in what the UN can do, which hasn't really held up through history, through UN intervention. But I think there's going to be a lot of disappointment, and they're going to realize that it's not a final solution. And I think one thing that's really been neglected about this conflict and about conflicts in general is, like I said before, is the rebellion. And people haven't been asking the rebels, you know, really hardly anything. And it's getting more complicated now because rebel groups are starting to fight against each other. But I think that supporting the rebellion in Darfur is one of the, you know, one of the best ways to really deal with this conflict. But saying that, I also think that, you know, what the people of Darfur feel they need in this situation should be also listened to. And, you know, one of those things is UN intervention. And, you know, this has been an issue in the past with, like, Rwanda when there was this kind of impending crisis and the world didn't do anything about it. And, you know, in that situation, I think it would have been probably beneficial if they would have. So I think it's right now, you know, it's a kind of necessary step, but, you know, absolutely not a final solution.
Definitely. And when you were doing research and journalism over in Darfur, were you aware of any outside, specifically like corporate interests owning agricultural land or having big stakes in any of the natural resources over in Darfur that you feel like have something to gain from this conflict? Or basically, I'm kind of wondering if there's like corporations or U.S. corporations kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes here for their own benefit that you can talk about.
I mean, right now there isn't. Darfur really has nothing, you know, that I can see that international corporations would be interested in. But there is the possibility, you know, there's been no, you know, search for oil in Darfur, but there is a lot of oil in South Sudan. It just hasn't been explored in Darfur. So it's definitely possible that those things exist there and that, you know, if it was easier for corporations to go there, that they could explore these kind of avenues. But right now there's not much. But there is the kind of large corporate aspect of the situation now actually has to do with China. And right now the situation with the UN intervening is that they need permission of the Sudanese government. They either need permission or they have to have, you know, a consensus with the Security Council. And the big problem with having that consensus is that China has a lot of corporate interests in Sudan, and they will never back. They'll always support the Sudanese government.
I see.
The U.S. used to have oil interests in Sudan, in South Sudan, and it actually, Chevron was the first company to find oil in Sudan, but Chevron withdrew from Sudan after a lot of international pressure because of the conflict in the south, and the government was basically using the same strategy in the south by arming, you know, militias as it is now in Darfur. And when people were seeing this, they kind of put pressure on Chevron, and all the U.S. oil companies pulled out of Sudan.
I see. Yeah, so now it's kind of a similar situation, except with China instead of Chevron. Is that what you're saying? I see.
Yeah.
Well, I know you got to get going, Shane. So thank you very much. Once again, we've been on the phone with Shane Bauer, independent journalist who just got back from Sudan. Wrote one of the cover stories for the new issue of Fault Lines, and actually sold a few stories to Al Jazeera, correct?
Right.
Well, congratulations. And thanks once again for talking with us today. Anyone who wants to read Shane's article in Fault Lines can find it in the Fault Lines section on indiebay.org. For Enemy Combatant Radio, I'm Liam O'Donohue.